Good morning. I'd like to call the Education Finance Division to order on, what is this, the 20th? 19th. Right what it says on the agenda. How handy is that? All right. Thank you, Ms. Burt. Good morning, everyone. As we have a quorum, I'd like to start us off with approving the minutes. We've got two sets of minutes in your folders. Representative Murphy. For February 13th and February 14th, or one at a time?
One at a time. I think we have to do them one at a time.
I thought so, too.
For the 13th.
For the 13th it is. We have a motion before us to approve the minutes from February 13th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Murphy, do you want to get on a roll here and do the 14th as well? Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Murphy motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails again. Representative Murphy?
Oh,
I know. Folks, look out. We have two primary orders of business today, members. One is a presentation on the Homework Starts at Home program. This is not a bill that is in the committee's possession. But it is part of that larger view of students at the center of our deliberations as a committee and looking at barriers to student success. And what we know from research here in Minnesota and elsewhere is that having experienced homelessness or being homeless as a student has a significant negative impact on academic achievement. And the Homework Starts at Home program will be better described by the people who are going to testify today, but is a response to that. Representative Howard is the chief author of the bill, but the presentation will be by a number of other people with perspective on the issue. We'll then later move to Representative Richardson's House File 813 on suicide prevention training. With that, I'd like to invite up Eric Grumdahl with the Minnesota Department of Education. Good morning, Mr. Grumdahl. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Brumdahl. I serve as the Director of Special Projects for the Minnesota Department of Education and the Minnesota Office to Prevent and End Homelessness. Thanks for having me here today. My job is to provide some background and framing around what we know about housing instability and its correlation to educational outcomes. And so the takeaway message that I would share with you as we get started is really that what we see across a variety of educational indicators is that students that face housing instability universally end up facing more significant challenges in achieving academic success. That holds true across almost every way that we can look at and measure that question. And the second big takeaway is that in the midst of such challenging circumstances, students and their families continue to demonstrate remarkable resilience, which we see very clearly in that when we're able to connect students with stable housing, we see immediate and dramatic changes in the trajectory for their educational success. The third key takeaway is that student homelessness exists on a scale that is probably surprising to most Minnesotans, perhaps not to you, but for most Minnesotans, the notion that on a given school day, the data that you're looking at on the slide there is from October 1st, 2017, we see almost 8,700 homeless students, I think 8,696 homeless students across more than 1,200 schools in 300 school districts spanning 76 counties. So student homelessness is not just an issue of urban centers. It's not even just an issue of rural hubs, regional hubs. It's an issue really that affects every community. I heard a very small rural community last week share the news that they have a 10% student homelessness rate. And so this is something that we see really across our state. It's also something that we know does not affect all Minnesota students equally, and student homelessness reflects the racial disparities and ethnic disparities that we see in homelessness more generally, really making the importance of centering our response to student homelessness in equity an imperative. So we see that African-American students are overrepresented compared to the general student body by a factor of 4.5 among students experiencing homelessness, and that disparity is even greater for American Indian students, where that disparity is 6.1. While the number of homeless students has grown substantially over the past decade, and in fact, when we look, we see a 17% per year average increase over the past decade, we have also seen in the last 2 years perhaps some promising signs that we are getting our hands around this problem, at least as it's measured on these kind of point-in-time methodologies, so that we're actually seeing, for the first time with the most recent data that's published, a decline in the number of students that were identified as homeless. That's good news, but also there remain 8,700 students that have not found a way out of that problem on any given day, and we know that the impact on their education is really stark. There's a growing body of research, and the state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota, really led by a team that includes Dr. Ann Mastin at the Institute for Child Development, has really documented tremendous impact across a range of dimensions for homeless students. And the graph that you see on the screen there is comparing proficiency levels on third grade math tests. We see very similar, almost identical pictures for reading as well. And what that picture demonstrates is that homeless students are substantially less likely to be proficient, even when compared with their low-income but otherwise housed counterparts. We know that those disparities, when they open, take a really long time to close, and so all the more reason to make sure that we're attending to those housing needs as early and as quickly as possible so that that doesn't happen. We see dramatic impacts on student attendance, and in fact, nearly 30% of homeless students qualify as chronically absent, which means that they've missed 10% or more of school days in a given year. You can imagine if you're facing a housing instability with your family and not sure where you're going to stay that night, the prospect of getting your kid to school every day can be challenging, even with the supports that exist to make that happen. And so really a critical piece of being able to make sure that we can't achieve our educational outcomes if we don't have kids in classrooms. So a really significant impact there. Based on a lot of what we've learned in 2013, MDE and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency partnered together to launch a pilot program that operated in three communities. And that program has served over two cohorts, nearly 250 families and nearly 500 students. What we've seen from the evaluation of that pilot is that we've had dramatic impact on the outcomes that we're most interested in. So 90% of families that were served by that program did, in fact, transition from the program into stable housing, so they were able to actually address that fundamental instability that was contributing to their child's academic challenges. We also were able to stabilize the attendance of the children that were in those families, which, again, we know is a critical precursor to then seeing that improvement educationally over time. And another important finding is that we also saw a significant increase in parental income, which, again, can help that family remain stably housed over time. So this graph gives you a picture of what stabilizing their attendance really means. When we look at the orange line, these are students that were supported by this program to stabilize in school, and we saw that we did not have a slip in their attendance, a significant change there. What we saw in contrast in the blue line are for students that were not stably housed, and in the gray line, homeless students in general, a significant decline over the study period for their attendance, which again dropped below that threshold of qualifying as chronically absent. The increase in income for families was significant. It resulted in about a $2,500 a year increase in income, which if you imagine that kind of working out on a monthly basis, this can really be the difference between housing being affordable or not being affordable. So we were really encouraged to see that, that parents and their families did, in fact, increase the resources they had to keep their families stabilized. Building on this pilot success with Homework Starts with Home, we wanted to really take this idea to an even larger scale and also to refine the way that services were provided so that we were reaching families as quickly as possible and also providing exactly the supports that they need. So one of the things that we heard from those programs through a request for information that we conducted in 2017 was a very clear need to have a broader diversity of supports available to families that could be deployed to respond to their specific needs. We actually have ended up with Homework Starts with Home incorporating not only rental assistance, which was the primary ingredient that the state provided previously, but also the Minnesota Housing Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, which can provide a range of flexible supports really tailored to meet whatever the specific housing barriers might be. The classic example of that program is, for example, if somebody needs a car repair to be able to retain their employment, to be able to retain their housing, it's the kind of program that can step in there quickly and resolve those fundamental barriers or challenges to housing stability. We also, importantly, created a partnership with philanthropy, and so the funding sources that were available to grantees under Homework Starts with Home included $250,000 from philanthropy dedicated to be braided with the public funds so that there was an opportunity for programs to identify uses where public dollars could support those uses, but also identify places where more flexible funding was needed. As a result of our community kind of input and listening, we identified this preliminary practice model, which I won't go through in detail, but the key point is really to strengthen the approach that our communities are using in being able to respond to this challenge, knowing that the particular supports that families need are often very individualized, and having those available rapidly and identifying students rapidly are critical ingredients. We also formalized the roles not only of schools as being critical partners in helping to identify and connect students with this program, but also the role of what you could call mainstream services, so programs that may not be targeted to families or students experiencing homelessness, but that could be absolutely critical to their ability to retain housing stability or exit homelessness if they are homeless. And those could include things like job training programs or economic assistance programs, public housing opportunities. And so all of those partners under Homework Starts with Home are formally involved in actually guiding, designing, and implementing the program, as I think you'll hear later. The last piece that I'll touch on is that through a really generous grant from the University of Minnesota, the Office of the Provost, we were able to actually assemble an amazing team to evaluate Homework Starts with Home as it is implemented using this new model. That evaluation is underway, and we're eager to see results of it. What I'll say is that it is a really broad look at what kind of evidence that we can assemble that will guide practice in the future so that as we take these approaches to an even larger scale needed to solve this problem, we have the best evidence possible. This slide is the impressive faculty team that's been assembled to help guide that work, led by Dr. Ann Mastin at the Institute for Child Development and Maria Hanready at the Humphrey School. And we also have a team of graduate student fellows that are also diving into specific projects that I think have direct kind of policy relevance and import as we think about how to take these kinds of approaches and solutions to scale. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll pause for questions.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for this presentation. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I missed what you said these pilot programs started what year?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, they started in 2014 in three communities, the Northside Achievement Zone in North Minneapolis, the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, and Clay County, which includes the city of Moorhead.
Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So they've been around or functioning for about 4 years total. So I'm curious on the issues that you have, which are definitely significant issues. We deal with the chronic absentee issue, the scores on reading and math, and then mental health. You had mentioned that you're tracking the absentee rate, and that has improved. I'm just wondering if you're tracking the actual scores to find out if this is impacting the students' reading and math scores.
Mr. Grundahl?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, we are doing. We are tracking the education scores, knowing that the initial analysis of that pilot data, we had a very short kind of pre and post period in which to do that analysis. Part of what our university team is really bringing are much more nuanced ways for us to actually track those improvements, and we now have a longer period of time to look at. So that is actually the analysis that is underway right now for students that were in that pilot. We're also working in partnership with MinLink, which stands for Minnesota Linking Information for Kids, at the Center for Advanced Studies in Child Welfare at the university. They have integrated data spanning a whole number of state data systems, child welfare, economic assistance programs, a variety of those systems, in addition to the educational data. So we're also using that integrated data to tell a much richer picture of what those impacts were, not only for kids, but for their families and parents as well.
Representative Bennett?
Mr. Chair, thanks so much. So that's wonderful, and I'm hoping that you'll share that data with us when that's available. I think that's important. And then my last question is, I agree with the importance of stable housing and so on, but I'm wondering why this isn't maybe coming. It seems like more of a welfare-type program, and why would the funding be coming out of education? Obviously, I understand the impact on education, but it's a little more kind of direct/indirect. So why would this funding come out of education versus going to, like, the Health and Human Services route?
Let me step in here, Reverend Bennett. This is not education funding.
Okay.
The Homework Starts at Home program, if I remember correctly, is out of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. But with that, I'll let smarter people respond more fully to your question. Mr. Grundahl?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the funding comes out of the Minnesota Housing, two Minnesota Housing programs, one called the Housing Trust Fund, the other called the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. And then in addition, the philanthropic partnership known as the Heading Home Minnesota Funders Collaborative, assembled from a variety of foundations, that $250,000 that's also included as part of what Homework Starts with Home grantees are deploying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. Mr. Grundahl, so you're housed in MDE. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, I'm in kind of an unusual role for state government in that I'm part of an interagency team that supports the state's Interagency Council on Homelessness. I'm based at the Department of Education and a member of that team, which includes staff from Minnesota Housing, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Veterans Affairs, really helping to organize at an enterprise level the state agency's work in preventing and ending homelessness.
And I think you just answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Grundahl, for your report. Are the student projects that used integrated data, are those available on a website for us to read? Because they're very intriguing topics, and I would like to learn from a couple of them what the researchers use, the students.
Mr.
Are they
Grundahl.
Available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, they're in process right now, and so they're not yet published. We're looking forward to having them out as well.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
So, Mr. Grundahl, will you make sure that we're notified when they're available for us to read? Thank you.
I'd be delighted.
Do you have an anticipated timeline?
Those projects are underway right now. We anticipate that they're going to need at least through the summer, and the timeline depends largely on when the remaining portions of integrated data that they're using for those analyses are available.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Any other questions for Mr. Grundahl? Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. McQuarrie?
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dominic McQuarrie. I'm Public Policy Manager at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. First off, and to Representative Erickson's question earlier, I'm delighted that the committee has taken time this morning to do an informational hearing on this topic. I know it's not a program that is necessarily within its jurisdiction, but the overlaps are significant, so I'm truly, truly appreciative of the time that we've been given today. Mr. Grumdahl was a late addition to our agenda, so he cannibalized a lot of the remarks that I had drafted. I think the only things that I would add quickly before turning it over to some folks who know much more deeply about this program are that, you know, the consequences and the impacts of this, they reach across silos. That the 2015 Wilder Homeless Survey showed that nearly 40% of families who had children who were homeless said that they had a child who had a school move because of their housing situation. That this isn't just housing instability, this is school instability. And, you know, school is not just the place where we go for academic education, it's where we go for behavioral and relational education as well, where we're making our first connections to people largely outside of our family and learning to build those bonds and communications across people. Another study that came out last year from the University of Minnesota showed that students who are homeless and in families who I think we oftentimes think of students who are in families as having a buffer to some of these consequences that unaccompanied youth don't have, they also showed statistically significantly higher rates of behavioral and emotional health impacts due to their homelessness and higher rates of even attempted suicide. So this is an issue that cuts across all of the different committees and all of the different jurisdictions that we have at the state. We are part of the Homes for All Coalition at the Wilder Foundation, over 200 organizations statewide, and we like to say where we live impacts everything. So with that, I'll turn it over to our next testifier.
Good morning, ma'am. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Erica Valiant. So I'm just going to tell about myself and my situation. So I was working for a financial firm. I had Series 7, Series 24, so some securities licenses, and I ended up losing my job and thinking to myself, well, you know, it shouldn't be that hard to get another job. I've got these licenses. They don't have to pay for me to be licensed, and it just didn't work out that way. And so my landlord let me stay in the house for like 4 months without paying because he didn't want to put me out. But eventually I said, you know what, I'm just going to go. I don't have any money. I don't have a job, and you need to make money. And I left and ended up being homeless for about 6 months with my three kids. And, you know, I was from house to house. I was with my sister, my cousin, my friend in the car, all these different places. And I had a hard time getting my kids to school on time or at all, depending on where I was, because everybody didn't live in the area. You know, I couldn't. There's a school bus that would bus them, but maybe not from where I happen to be that night. And I end up going to get a letter because one of my kids was truant because he missed so many days. My now nine-year-old, or he was late so many times. I would try to get them to school, and sometimes I would make it, but it wouldn't be on time. And I would think to myself, well, you know, at least they're here. But, you know, the school doesn't care about that. You have to be on time. You have to be here. And, you know, they care, but there are all these rules around kids being in school on time. So I was going to get them to school either late or not at all, but they were getting there. And eventually I had to tell the school that, look, I'm homeless. I didn't want to tell them because I was embarrassed. Because it's embarrassing. Like, you don't just come go to school one day and say, hey, I'm homeless. My kids don't have anywhere to stay. But eventually I had to tell them because they're wondering, like, hey, what's going on? Why are kids always late? You know, they're not sick. What's the problem? So once I did tell them, I was talking to Culture and Wellness Center, somebody who has an office in the schools, and she told me about the Families Motivated to Succeed program, which is funded through Homework Starts from Home. And I put an application in. I was accepted, and I ended up getting a house in August. So it was about 6 months after I became homeless. So after I got housed, my kids were no longer late for school. They didn't miss any days unless they were literally sick or had a doctor's appointment. I ended up getting a much better job than what I had, right? And I ended up doing work with the St. Paul Private Neighborhoods Parent Council, which taught me all about advocacy work and coming up to speak about things like this. Which helped me to get my job because they're like, hey, you got community engagement experience. You've got experience doing this. We love to have you here, right? And then from that, I ended up being a part of the Neighborhood Leadership Program and Community Equity program. And now I'm even doing work with the Education Partnership Coalition to help teach other parents and all their other sites how to do the kind of stuff that we do with Parent Council. So I'm saying all this to say that not only does Homework Starts from Home help with homelessness and help with kids being able to get to school and do what they need to do in school on time or at all, it also opens up so many other opportunities for parents, which in turn opens up opportunities for the kids. One more thing to add, you know, too, just as to let you know, like, kind of how it was during that time. You know, my kids, when we were at other people's house, they would always tell me, like, Mom, I want to go home. I want to go to my room. I want to go back to our house. Because, you know, I was usually with family members who had other children. They would be like, well, this is mine. This is mine. This is mine. There's nothing my kids could say was theirs, right? And it was really hard for me to just say, when they, like, I want to go home. I didn't say, we don't have a home. I would just say, okay, we'll go home later, right? So that's it.
Ms. Valiant, thank you very much for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
One moment. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Valiant, I'm just kind of curious, after you made the application to the school or wherever, how long did it take you to get placed then?
Ms. Valiant?
So it took a couple of months.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Vernosh? Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the time to speak. My name is Ryan Vernosh, and I am the proud principal of Maxfield Elementary School in St. Paul, where we continue to serve the amazing children of the Rondo community for 128 years and counting. I want to share with you just a little bit about the impact of homelessness, of youth homelessness in particular, on schools, and my school in particular. I want to take you back several weeks, back when a mom of three came into my office in tears. She and her children were kicked out of her apartment and were forced onto the streets after emergency funding for a hotel rental. She couldn't find a shelter that would take her family. And when she was able to find a shelter possibility, she had to take yet another day off of work to finalize child care arrangements. And that's when her employer told her that if she did, she may lose her job. Through her tears, Mom said, "Do I chance not having a job to find a shelter for the night, or do I go to work and have another night on the street? I just can't win, Mr. Vernosh. What am I supposed to do? And I don't care about me. I just want to make sure my babies are safe." Now, let's rewind back to another moment. A different family, the same dire situation. Mom comes in with her twin kindergartners and shares, "We were just kicked out of our apartment last night, and they forced us out. We had to sleep in the car and wait for the school to open. We need help. We didn't even have time to get our stuff. Look, Mr. Vernosh, my baby only has one shoe. My baby only has one shoe. I just want my baby safe. And that's what I'm here for, to get a commitment from this committee, from this legislature, to ensure that we keep our baby safe. Safe from the devastation that experiencing homelessness brings upon children." Now, it would be one thing if these were isolated stories, but the sad reality is that they're not. And it cuts across all areas of the state, urban, suburban, and rural. And these are just two examples from a long list that we hear just at our school. Two stories out of thousands of similar ones across our state. Now, in my district, St. Paul Public Schools, we identify about 2,000 students as experiencing homelessness each year. The students qualify under the McKinney-Vento Act, which means, among other protections, they have rights to attend their school of origin. Every year, St. Paul Public Schools sets up about 1,000 routes for students to return to their St. Paul school of origin, regardless of where they're living in the metro area. Due to the limited number of family emergency shelter beds, 65% of our students are doubling up with others, forcing them to move frequently due to multiple stressors on both families. And many times, a doubled-up situation puts the other family at risk of eviction because there are too many people living in the rental unit. Project REACH, the McKinney-Vento program in St. Paul Schools, has identified about 75 families as living in a place not meant for human habitation, including their cars, the train, a park, or storage units. The verification allows the families to have priority on the shelter list. However, at the end of December, there were 79 families or 178 children on the wait list. The average wait list time is 40 days. And since the shelters are always at capacity at 104 beds, we could fill the emergency shelter with just St. Paul school children 2.5 times over. And the situation is not unique for Minnesota. At our school, back at Maxfield, about 25 to 30% of our scholars experience homelessness at some point throughout the year. And that's just the families that we know of that request support. We know that number is actually higher because of the stigma attached to not wanting to say that they are homeless to receive those supports. And as a school, we operate on the reactive side of the housing equation when all preventative systems have fallen short. And as such, we know that every first of the month, we need to be ready to greet more families that are newly homeless. We need to ensure our food pantry is stocked, that our counselor and social workers are available, and that our partner agencies are ready for more referrals. It's like clockwork every month. As a side note, that's also a reason why we need at least a 3-3 on the per pupil formula. The impact of homelessness on students, though, is overwhelming. Poor attendance, chronic illness, sleep deprivation, anxiety, increased need for mental health supports, difficulty in concentration, hunger, and much lower school achievement. And I see the impact on the faces of our children every morning when I greet them off the Project Reach vans. Sometimes they need to take a nap before they even go to class. Sometimes they need to get a change of clothes from our supply closet. Sometimes they just need an extra breakfast or a tight hug to reassure that they are beautifully brilliant and the challenges they are experiencing are not their fault. The children I am privileged to serve at my school are resilient beyond belief, but they should not be forced to be that resilient. Homelessness is a solvable problem. Ending homelessness means that we prevent it whenever possible, and when it's not possible, the experience of homelessness is rare, brief, and non-reoccurring. Good news is Minnesota, we've got a track record of solutions that work, and it will take the political will to prioritize this work. Homework Starts with Home is an important piece to this overall framework that needs to be implemented to end the housing stability crisis in our communities, because no child should question where they lay their head at night. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to my story and the stories of the families I serve. And thank you for your commitment and service. And I truly believe that together we can enact powerful and meaningful change for the families and children of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vernosh. Next up, is it Janaya? Fargarus?
Janaya.
Janaya. My apologies. Please introduce yourself for the tape. Welcome to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Janaya Bagarusi. I'm the Director of Family Supportive Housing Services with the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. Thank you for allowing me to speak before you this morning to share some insights into Wilder's whole family work, our experience in the highly mobile pilot, and our intentions going forward with Homework Starts with Home. The Wilder Foundation is working on providing support and interventions that stabilize and strengthen whole families. Too often, systems of support can be difficult for families to access and navigate on their own. Wilder seeks solutions that are family-driven, strength-based, and trauma-informed. Wilder has been working to transform our internal structures, processes, and measures to focus on outcomes for children and adults together. Because when families are stable, the community is stronger. Stable families help children grow into their potential, offer the strong foundation necessary for all family members to fulfill their sense of purpose, and are the bedrock of vibrant, productive communities. It is our desire at Wilder to bring hope, resilience, and calm to students, classrooms, and whole families through proven mental health, education, and supportive programming. We aim to fight poverty with promising new approaches that support families as a unit, generating good shared outcomes for children, adults, and seniors so that families can thrive. Activate youth leaders and leaders of color to fuel authentic community and system reform. Within Family Supportive Housing Services, we provide housing options and traditional case management services to families, single adults, and youth exiting homelessness. We have permanent supportive housing, transitional housing, and rapid rehousing programs. We work with housing developers in site-based housing and with a network of landlords to secure affordable and safe housing across the metro area. In the last few years, we have also been fortunate enough to provide rental assistance support for the prevention of homelessness for families connected to our school-based mental health programs. And in this last year, we have provided prevention support to parenting youth in maintaining their housing or securing housing immediately so that they don't fall into homelessness. Our work on the highly mobile pilot began in 2014 as one of the three pilot sites. From the beginning of the pilot to now, we have been fortunate enough to provide rental assistance and supportive case management services for 89 homeless and highly mobile families living in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood geographic area who had at least one child attending Jackson Elementary, Maxfield Elementary, or St. Paul City School. Rental assistance was provided for 24 months, and case management services were provided by the Cultural Wellness Center. In the first year of the program, we served 49 families, and what we learned from those families, 86% of them were headed by single female households, 81% of the families were identified as Black or African American. The average monthly income per family was approximately $1,000 at program entry. Before enrolling in the program, 51% were literally homeless, 39% of those families were doubled up with family, and 12% were doubled up with friends. And as you've heard from previous speakers, the children in the program at entry had slightly lower average attendance rates that previous school year, and they had a higher rate of chronic absence than other students enrolled in the St. Paul Public Schools. The key findings from small group discussion and surveys indicated from that first cohort that most families secured housing that met all of their needs. Families experienced improvements in the safety and health of their home relative to prior housing experience. Families were able to spend more time together and improve their family relationships. Families were experiencing improved well-being, reduced stress, both financially and psychologically, and of course, attendance improved for the children. We are currently under an extension of this pilot to allow for our remaining 12 to 15 families to fully utilize that rental assistance for the full 24 months. We believe our early learnings will continue to be demonstrated in the remaining pilot months, and all of that has informed our program design for Homework Starts with Home. With Homework Starts with Home, we will serve 95 to 100 households over the next 3 years. We will include families and unaccompanied youth who are literally homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness. We will provide progressive case management services, which are very intensive services up front, and then ongoing case management services as needed and requested by the families, although it will be required that face-to-face contact happen with the case manager every 90 days to assess needs and update goal plans. Families or youth may positively exit the program long before the 24-month time period, and additional households will then be added. Wilder is providing the progressive case management services, and we are partnering with the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, St. Paul Public Schools, and Wilder School-Based Mental Health Services. We are working with an additional 13 schools than from the pilot. We are committed to working with the households holistically and putting supports for housing, mental health, education, and basic needs in place. And we will be accepting applications for this new round of programming next week. As you've heard before, just under 30% of the children attending the schools we are partnering with in Homework Starts with Home are homeless. The need is real and prevalent. Having a place to call home allows so many other things to fall into place for families and young adults. When you don't have to worry about where you will sleep at night, you can focus on safety, stability, personal and family goals, employment, mental health, physical health, and yes, attending school daily and completing homework. Thank you for your interest and support of Homework Starts with Home.
Thank you, Ms. Bagarussi.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I saw Representative Richardson with a box of treats, and I know that she has a bill before the committee, so I wanted to do a time check with you and see if we're doing okay.
We've got 10 more minutes.
Okay.
Appreciate the sensitivity, however.
Wonderful. Thank you. And in a demonstration of the great collaboration and community that's going on at their site, Ms. Kaufman from Solid Ground is ceding her time to the other two testifiers from the suburban Ramsey area. So she is not testifying, just as an FYI.
Well, thank you, Ms. Kaufman.
So I'm going to assume that one of you is Ms. Hansen and the other Ms. Mason.
Yes, I'm Mary Sue Hansen. I'm the director of the Suburban Ramsey Family Collaborative.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And my name is Jenny Mason. I am the director of St. Andrew's Community Resource Center in Montemite.
Thank you very much. Again, welcome.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to start. I work for the Suburban Ramsey Family Collaborative and have for 20 years. So that includes everything in Ramsey County except St. Paul proper. So we work in the Family Service Collaborative structure, and that was legislation from Arne Carlson way back in the day. And about 7 years ago, we saw an uptick in homelessness to the point where we really didn't have enough collaboration going on to address homelessness. So we did a lot of work to bring our school link community social workers together from different social service agencies. And we partnered with Ramsey County, and we partnered with our libraries, who are seeing a lot of homelessness, people sleeping in the woods in Maplewood and Roseville areas. So we partnered with these agencies to say, what can we do more that we haven't done? And we actually then worked with our faith communities, and we organized and raised awareness in the suburbs because people didn't think we had homelessness in the suburbs. We actually last year had 800 students who are homeless in our four school districts. That's four school districts, 57 schools. 800 students are homeless. And just today, we brought all of our partners together for a breakfast kickoff for the Homework Starts with Home. And the count is already at 767 students. So this is mid-school year, and we're already going over the, almost over the 800. One of the things that we are trying to do is bring together all sectors to help us with this issue. Not only faith communities, not only working with Ramsey County, not only working with our partners in social service agencies, but really looking at what businesses can help us with, corporations can help us with, health organizations, because we see this as a health, learning, safety, and security crisis. This crosses all issues with families. And so one of the things Jenny's going to talk about a little bit more is what are the faith communities doing in our community to address homelessness through their partnering?
And I trust it's Reverend Mason?
It is.
The collar is a dead giveaway.
I trot it out sometimes.
Please proceed, Reverend.
Thank you. So St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Montemite, we began our work 8 years ago because of the gap we perceived in serving those who are homeless and facing housing instability, and began housing families in hotels. Later moved to a model of working with the shelter that was started by Guardian Angels Church in Oakdale. And 30 congregations support that work. And then just last year, we opened a new shelter in Hugo, Minnesota, supported by 13 congregations. Homelessness is growing in the suburbs as well as poverty in general. And I think it's difficult for people. Not only is the stigma of facing homelessness and poverty, but living in the suburbs and facing that as well. And yet it is there. And we have seen that the numbers are growing each year. One of the things that we've done at St. Andrews is gather the McKinney-Vento liaisons, the homeless and highly mobile student liaisons from each of the school districts that we work with, to provide a space of welcome and support for them, because many of them are doing their work in the school districts without any FTE to support that work. So as one of them says, who is doing this work with a zero FTE for the homeless work, he says, "I feel like I'm doing my lousy best." And I think we can do more than our lousy best. The Homework Starts with Home grant gives us an opportunity to do more than that for the children and families in our school districts. We came together in this collaborative with Solid Ground and Suburban Ramsey Family Collaborative and St. Andrews to focus on the four Suburban Ramsey school districts, where, as Mary Sue stated, there's almost 800 students already this year that are homeless and highly mobile. And we've just begun. We have literally just begun. We've housed two
families. We're working with three others at this point. So we're just at the beginning of that work and hoping to focus both on prevention as well on rehousing families that have become homeless. We're looking to grow all of our partnerships, not only with businesses and landlords and schools, but also with faith communities, so that we can say, you know, we all need to work together to make change. And our children need change, and this will certainly reverberate throughout all the families and make our communities better. I'm sure there's things I'm forgetting to say, but that's all I'd like to share right now.
Thank you, Reverend Mason. Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the opportunity to talk about this in the Housing Committee a week or so ago, but given the topic, I thought I would share a little bit today, too. On January 23rd, I had the opportunity to go out with the homeless outreach organization, Ally Supportive Services, worked with Dakota County. It's the annual point-in-time homeless count. And so that night we went out and we were trying to locate homeless people so that we could count them. And if you recall, a week or so after that was when the temperature got bitter cold, the 30 degrees below zero. And so, Reverend Mason, I just want to thank you because you opened your doors that night. Mm-hmm. I got a call from Amber Hansen, who is the outreach coordinator. The day she was actually searching for locations to place homeless people, and she said, "Great news! St. Andrews and Montevita is opening their doors." Okay. And so, that's real life. When you have the opportunity to go out and you see these people and you meet these people, and you're worried about them when the temperature is 25, 30 degrees below zero, and then you hear of a church like St. Andrews that opened their doors, I just want to say thank you for doing that.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Mason, your good work reaches all the way down into southern Dakota County, like Representative Jurgens said. I just have one question for you. Do you have a financial impact on your parish of what you're putting out monthly for this service, approximate?
Reverend Mason?
Thank you. So the Community Resource Center at St. Andrews has a budget of about $600,000 a year, which is raised from donations from congregants, not a part of the church budget. But then we receive a great deal of in-kind from our congregation with the facility and all of those costs, another $300,000 and that we estimate in that cost, the many, many volunteers. The Homework Starts with Home funding is completely separate from that. And, you know, clearly we need to raise more dollars to be able to do that. The prevention needs of the families that come are very high, as our previous testifier shared. She was 4 months of not being able to pay her rent, and I'm sure then with a very high debt, families are coming to us with $2,000 and $3,000, $4,000 worth of debt that they need to pay down just to be able to get rehoused. And so that's a heavy lift, but one that we think we can do as we share and we ask for help in the community.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Mason, and on top of this, you're keeping the lights on and doing your work that you're doing in your own parish. Is that correct?
Reverend Mason.
Yes, and I would say it's a large congregation with very generous people, and yes, we are keeping our lights on, and we see that this is part of what we're called to do, and I think we feel called to provide leadership in the community because we can and because we feel and see the need.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both Ms. Hansen and Pastor Mason for your collaboration. That is so important, and especially to St. Andrews as a faith community to reach out. You know, we have these issues in rural Minnesota, too, and I just want to cite one example of before Christmas, a family in Princeton, a mother with five children was evicted, and word came to our church, a Lutheran church as well, that this had happened. And so I got a group of my friends together, and we put together some funding so they'd have a place to stay through Christmas. And then we each went about trying to find rental housing, and we did achieve that. But I think the message that we should send to our schools, our districts, our charters, is that the faith community is a place for people to go. Mm-hmm. And we're going to minister to them for their needs in more ways than one. And that's so important that we can bring this healing to our people as they see us reach out in our faith to serve. So I hope that, you know, we can send that message across the state. And in rural Minnesota, where I know small churches like mine, you know, struggle, but we're benevolent. We want to help others. And when they have a need, we reach out. The quilters in my church provided at our youth center, where many of our homeless spend every day, quilts at Christmas. We send food to them. And we have the principal from Princeton High School here today, too. And they have a food shelf. And my church is very generous in providing to the food shelf so that when the children leave on the weekend, they're going home with something in case they don't have food at home. So thank you again for the collaboration that goes on. But particularly, let's get the message out that it's the job of the faith community, as Pastor Mason said, to reach out and to help these people.
Representative Erickson. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just would like to give a special shout-out to St. Andrews. My parents actually are members there, and I went there when I was in high school. That was a lot of years ago until I moved away to Albert Lea. But I do know the impact that St. Andrews has on the community and obviously a lot of surrounding areas, and I want to thank you for that. And I've visited your church now and then when I visit my family, so thank you.
Big day for the Lutherans here in front of the Education Finance Committee. I want to thank you all. Mr. McQuarrie, do you have any closing comments? Thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Mr. McQuarrie.
Awesome. Thank you. And in closing, I just want to reiterate that, you know, family homelessness and student homelessness is a community issue, and it takes a community response. And I'm happy that we were able to show an example of that. I know the site out in Clay County that has 40 organizations working across 5 counties on this issue is another wonderful example of the work that's going on. The Homework Starts with Home program, through the help of Representative Cresha, who I was hoping would be here today, was able to secure some one-time funding last session, but there is no base appropriation for this. So while I know that this committee does not have jurisdiction over the funding for this, I would ask that everyone would support Representative Howard's House File 1401, which was introduced yesterday. We really want to make sure that the people who are doing the great work in community can continue to serve families so that we can make strong families and strong communities. So I'm around if anybody has any further questions, or I can connect them to anyone related to the program. And just want to thank the committee again for the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. McQuarrie. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there not in House File 2 a $4 million funding transfer from the education budget? Is that not included in House File 2?
Representative Erickson, House File 2 does have the Homework Starts at Home proposal, but not out of the education budget, I don't believe.
Mr. McQuarrie? I think there's a transfer.
Yeah, so I believe as a part of messaging the impact of housing related to education, there was something included there, and the money would then transfer to Minnesota Housing for the administration through the traditional funding streams of the Housing Trust Fund and the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. But we have a standalone bill that Representative Howard is carrying, which is House File 1401, which would go directly through the Housing Finance Committee. Yes.
Thank you for correcting me. Thank you very much. To the testifiers all, thank you for taking time out of your day and coming and sharing your perspectives and your experiences. Very much appreciated. Representative Richardson, that means you. Representative Richardson, would you like to move that House File 813 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future Education Finance Division report?
Yes, so move, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you very much. And I understand that there is an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move that to be before the committee?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Members, this is an author's amendment. Representative Richardson has moved it. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Richardson, then, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 813, as amended, would require the Minnesota Department of Education to award a $480,000 grant to a nationally recognized provider of evidence-based training on suicide prevention. The grant recipient would be required to make this online training available to teachers statewide. We are facing a serious public health crisis in our communities and in our schools. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for youth between the ages of 10 and 17, and we know that there are intersections between mental illness and suicide. In fact, there was an underlying mental illness in 90% of the youth who completed suicide. In Minnesota, there are also troubling statistics, as the completed suicide rate for 10 to 19-year-olds is higher than the national average. In 2016, 48 youth between the ages of 10 and 19 died by suicide in Minnesota. According to a Minnesota Department of Education student survey, 497 eighth graders reported that they had seriously considered suicide. By 11th grade, that number almost doubles to 9,352 students reporting that they are considered, that they've seriously considered suicide. Public health crises require community-based responses and strategies. And while these statistics point to a serious public health problem, we know that suicide is preventable. The realities are that our kids spend a lot of time at school, and it's one of the primary places that they're living their lives, and so focusing on suicide prevention at school makes sense. It's where our children are, and it's also where problems can manifest. One part of the strategy is ensuring educators are effective partners in suicide prevention. We want to make sure that they're better prepared to effectively identify students who are at risk and that they have the tools that they need to engage with students and the appropriate follow-ups. This is going to be important to ensure that they have the necessary skills and the confidence to intervene with at-risk youth. In 2016, legislation was passed in Minnesota requiring teachers to take 1 hour of evidence-based suicide prevention training as part of licensure renewal. We have some testifiers here today that will speak to the benefits of that training, but for some schools, there have been challenges. There's been challenges with training implementation, organizing that training, and ensuring access to quality and evidence-based content across the state. This bill is an opportunity to ensure schools across the state have access to an online evidence-based suicide prevention training. And by bundling contracting resources with one provider, it offers a cost-effective way to build the capacity of teachers and to create schools that are more effectively able to identify at-risk students and intervene as well. With that, I can stand for questions, or we can move on with our next testifier, Sue Abderholden.
Representative Richardson, let's move on to testifiers before we take questions. Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I want to thank you for hearing House File 813, which would fund the online suicide prevention training for teachers, which is actually language that you also passed last year. So as you know, the legislature passed a bill in 2016 requiring teachers to have 1 hour of suicide prevention training. And this was in response to the increased number of youth dying by suicide and the increased number of students in the student survey responding that they had thought about or attempted suicide. In a national report released in May, researchers found that suicidal ideation has steadily increased and that half involved teens aged 15 to 17, 37% were ages 12 to 14, and almost 13% were children ages 5 to 11. Girls made up nearly two-thirds of those cases. Now, we don't expect teachers to treat students, but we want them to know the signs and symptoms, and most importantly, what to do if a student shares that they or a friend are suicidal. NAMI provides a mental health education program for high school students called Ending the Silence. And after nearly every presentation, a student approaches my staff worried about themselves or someone else. We encourage schools to let us do the one-hour evidence-based class to teachers. It's called QPR, Question, Persuade, and Refer, so that they know what to do if a student comes up to them after we leave. QPR is good and it's short, but it's still hard to arrange for all the teachers and staff to be there at one time. In 2016, the Minnesota Department of Health put some funding towards trying out an online suicide prevention training. The money was actually funneled through NAMI so that we could track the schools and the outcomes. There were 30 schools and 1,064 staff completed the training. 95% to 97% said they would recommend the training to a colleague, which is a very high number, and 79% said that they were more prepared to discuss a sign of distress with a student after the training. Charter schools actually had the highest usage of the training. People who took the training said that the scenarios seemed real, that they actually had students like that, and that they appreciated being able to practice speaking to the student or the parent. Funding the online training for all teachers and staff across the state does bring efficiency in terms of funding. You get a better deal the more schools that you cover. But it also eliminates the barriers that teachers and staff have accessing training, especially in rural Minnesota. And frankly, it's a much better training than what we have now, much better than QPR. We are all concerned about the mental health of our youth, so let's make sure that teachers and staff has the best training possible to prevent suicide among our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Richardson, you have other testifiers?
Yes. We have two other testifiers.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tamara Pulver. I work as a director of special ed with charter schools. Good morning, Chairman and committee members. It's an honor to address the House to advocate for House File 813. I work with charter schools, and due to the smaller setting, we get a large number of students with disabilities. The enrollment is greater than the state average. Majority of these students are dealing with mental health issues and trauma. So, you know, staff always wonder and ask, what's the difference between a student that just needs to buck up and one who's in serious trouble? It's really every day in Minnesota schools, teachers, paras, office staff, bus drivers, and food service people all have to interact with students that are engaged in self-harm, suicidal ideation, despair, and hopelessness. Knowing how to respond is critical to the health and welfare of the child. We all want and need effective training in suicide prevention. I received a grant for all staff at my charter schools to access the Cognito training. It was well received, even by veteran social workers. The interactive role-playing of students from different backgrounds with different needs was very instructive, and the feedback was all positive from staff. There are three different developmental levels, elementary, middle school, and high school. And adults can log in at school or at home. They can stop and resume the training as needed. Staff from Greater Minnesota and the metro area, where all my charter schools are, had equal access to the training when it was convenient for them. As you know, licensed staff must complete the suicide prevention training. The beautiful thing about Cognito is how available and accessible it is to all non-licensed staff, many of whom have deep and meaningful relationships with our students. Cognito instructs staff how to talk to vulnerable kids, what kinds of questions to ask, when to refer them, and how to support them in getting help. It's so important that we all have this knowledge to recognize when our kids are in serious trouble and need us the most. People that die by suicide do things and say things that are tells. So we need to instruct our staff what those things are. We need more resources for schools to address mental health needs for our students. We need training for all the adults that interact with students. Cognito training is for suicide prevention is desperately needed now, as the death by suicide rate is sadly increasing. I want to thank you for your time and your thoughtful consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Pulver. Representative Richardson, you have one other testifier?
Yes, we have one more testifier, Ms. Muckenhorn.
Good
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for traveling down today. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Barb Muckenhern. I am the principal at Princeton High School. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of supporting the Cognito Suicide Prevention Training through NAMI, Minnesota. I've been the principal at Princeton for 6 years, and in this time period, students presenting with mental health and social-emotional issues has gone from our primary concern to an overwhelming need that we cannot fulfill for our students. Not only are schools understaffed in this area, schools actually have a lack of trained staff members. We do not have a social worker, for example, at Princeton High School at all. Continuing education for teachers for teacher licensure is now required in the area of mental health awareness and suicide prevention. However, it is actually a challenge very often for teachers to acquire this training and quality training. School districts are trying to provide it, but it's not easy to do so. There's a limited professional development time in the yearly calendar, with many needs and other requirements also vying for this professional development time and funds. Even when we might have time allocated or allotted to this training, it becomes a challenge to find the quality training. Our expertise in schools, sadly, is not mental health counseling or suicide prevention. So we struggle to even develop our own quality training. When the opportunity arose a couple of years ago to work with NAMI Minnesota to provide Cognito training, I thought, I've got to give this a try. I haven't seen anything else like this, and I haven't seen anything else like it since. To my surprise, it was a quality experience and provided the following benefits. It was free to our middle school and high school staff, all staff. That was a gift. Staff could access this training day or night, which was extremely convenient. The system was easy to use and worked as intended, which is a surprise. So even though we were among the first, the glitches were very insignificant and easily solved. The training was interactive, and the learner is forced to engage. You can't just click through the training. The training was effective, and staff liked it, and that matters. Our activities director, Mr. Labs, shared this quote that I could share with you today. I thought I would breeze through it, but that was not the case. I was surprised at how helpful it was. It kept looping me back to the student in the scenario until I made choices that ended in something helpful for that student instead of a dead-end choice on my part that shut down the conversation. And I've had similar feedback from other teachers. I strongly urge you to support providing this training to the education community in Minnesota. Our students need us to know what to do. And that only happens with quality training and learning opportunities such as the training like Cognito can provide. Please help us help our students. This is the most important thing we do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McInherney. Members, in your packet, additionally, is a letter from Ms. Charbonneau-Folk from the Big Lake Schools, also in support of the training. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Princeton High School. Please, I'd like to just, on behalf of my brother, Lee Detmer.
No, of course it is.
Who taught at Princeton for 30-plus years. And I think retired, what, 3 years ago, 2 years ago?
Ms. Muckenberg?
Like four.
4 years ago.
4 years ago.
But just wanted to say hi. You know, just tell, when you see Lee, just tell him you met his better-looking brother.
I will certainly do that.
I believe he sent the same message to her beforehand, so.
We're just 18 months apart, so.
All right.
It's great to meet you.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson. This is such a great bill and such an important area that we're addressing here. Mm-hmm. I just have a few questions. I want to know specifically, how long does the training take? I actually checked out Cognito's website, and it's really, if you haven't looked at it, I would suggest going on. Very user-friendly. But also, what areas of mental health training does this cover? as somebody that's practiced as a therapist myself, we know many different avenues can lead to suicide. And so I don't know if it would be better for Sue Abderholden to come up and address that.
Representative Richardson, who's taking the pitch?
Sue, I think, can answer those questions.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. It covers really more, you know, if you think about suicide prevention training, you're not trying to diagnose or anything like that. You're trying to figure out how to question and talk to the individual who may be suicidal. And so it really focuses more on that dialogue and conversation about what to say and how to engage, not just, as they said earlier, shutting down the conversation. Mm-hmm. So it really helps you learn how to do that. And then you refer. So you're not necessarily, you know, handling that crisis, but really trying to figure out if, in fact, that student is suicidal, and then where do you go from there?
Mm-hmm. Representative Edelson?
And then how long does the training take?
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's supposed to take an hour, but we've also heard that sometimes, because it's the hour that's required, which is why we looked into this, mm-hmm. But if someone wants to kind of keep going back over and over again, it could, of course, take more than an hour, or if they keep answering wrong. Frankly, it's going to take a little bit longer.
All right. Representative Edelson.
So just one more. Thank you, Chair. So this covers the suicide one-hour training from past and previous session.
Representative Richardson, Ms. Abderholden.
Yes.
Thank you. Right. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a little more serious note here, I know we provided some funding last year in the bill. Staff development money, I know that's set aside 2% each year for a school district budget. Could this be run through staff development? That's my question.
Mr. Strom, can you review for the committee the 2% set aside and the requirements around that, please?
Mr. Chair, members, part of each district's general education revenue, 2% of the formula allowance, is set aside for staff development activities, and those activities now are under the control of the school board. There's a list in statute of the activities, but I presume a class like this or a course like this would fit under the requirements in 122A60 for staff development.
And Mr. Strom, to your reference that those monies are currently under the authority of the school board, is a reference that previously it was control of those monies, if I recall correctly, went to the staff development committee, and so is teachers and administration jointly making decisions on the expenditures? Can you remind me? Help me.
Mr. Chair, members, there was formerly in statute, there was a three-way split, including mm-hmm. some money decided at the site level, some money decided by the board level for site-specific activities, but it was a three-way split before the most recent set of changes.
Thank you very much. Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, if I could add, including in last year's bill, one of the reasons not to do it school district by school district is because if you go in with one state contract, you frankly get efficiencies, cost efficiencies in there, and so the total cost is a lot less, which is why even last year and again this year we're proposing to do it that way.
Representative Detmer, did you have more?
Yeah, and I understand, you know, my 34 years teaching, there's always a big demand for the staff development money. And teachers have put in their requests. The district would have their programs that they set aside with staff development money. So that was just a question mm-hmm. that I know if you look at a school district budget of 70-some million dollars, and that's a pretty big hunk of change for staff development. So just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Ms. Abderholden, while this may be an appropriate response to the increase in suicidal ideation being seen amongst youth, how do we get below that below the response to the causes? Do you have insights, is there research that provides insights into why we're seeing the increase in suicidal ideation?
Mr. Chairman, some of the studies I've read look to a number of things. One is contagion. So what you see is maybe in a high school, you see one student take their life, and then soon after, several others. And part of that, frankly, is how we communicate and message that. And the health department, through their public health nurses and departments, are also trying to work when that happens in a school to actually work on making sure that you're doing the right things, not to promote contagion. One key example, for example, is you never tell and never share in media or anything how someone took their life. Asking someone if they're suicidal does not plant the thought, but actually talking about the means that they use does. One example is after Robin Williams' death, where the media, frankly, was horrible in terms of putting out every single detail. There was a huge increase in the number of people who died by suicide by those means. So there are things like that that we need to work on to make sure that we're not promoting contagion. I think the other thing that we know is that trauma is playing a larger role. I did notice that one of the new trainings that Cognito has come out with is actually an online training on trauma. But we do need to kind of understand that as well. And then I think building resilience in children is also another thing that we have to focus on both as parents and as adults in our community, so that one small setback doesn't lead to a child, a student, thinking that, well, then that's it. I don't really have any other options. And then finally, I would say that making sure that we have places to refer children to, so that, you know, I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan, an advocate for school-linked mental health, so that if we do find a child that someone's worried about, that they're not waiting 3 months to get into treatment, but that they're actually, you know, really seeing someone right away, so that they can resolve that and try to make sure that, you know, the student really understands why suicide is not an option.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up with what your comments just were, Ms. Abderholden, is the training, this one-hour training right now, does it address the contagion and how to communicate to students about that also?
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pryor, I do not believe so. There's a whole kind of another work that goes on in terms of safe messaging. You know, we have actually sent materials to all of the school districts in Minnesota several years ago about what safe messaging is and what to do. And we provide, through a grant through the health department, a class called Postvention, where you come in after a suicide has taken place to actually provide that kind of training and information.
Representative Pryor. Thank you. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recognize that this request is just a single year appropriation. What sort of thoughts do you have for ongoing in-service training or teacher preparation for new teachers? And also, I wonder if there's attention to suicide prevention in teacher preparation programs.
Representative Richardson, Ms. Abderholden, your choice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, what we'd like to see is if everyone really loves us, let's continue it, right? If we've had 30 schools, which is 30 school districts, which is small, let's see if this is really popular and people really feel that it's effective, then we would, of course, want to continue it. If something's working, right, continue to do that. There is, to my knowledge, there isn't a lot in kind of the teacher education about mental illness in general and suicide prevention, although we are seeing that in general in the community more and more people are at least taking a suicide prevention class because they're worried about it, and anyone who's working with youth in particular is looking to take those kinds of classes so that they really understand what's going on. There are many organizations, you know, not just NAMI, but many that offer the QPR one-hour class for free. We offer it twice a month for free in our office just so anyone can come by and be able to take that kind of education. You know, a lot of people know CPR and first aid, and I think the time has really come that people really understand and increase their mental health literacy as well.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Abderholden, once the grant is awarded, like it was to Princeton, is there access then to that training ongoing so that it's, you know, more like a permanent software access that the teachers and other staff have it? Can use?
Chairman, Representative Erickson, my understanding is that it's for a certain amount of time and that that contract would then have to be renewed.
Representative.
But as many people as you want in that district can take it.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So principal from Princeton, Ms. Muckenhorn.
Principal Muckenhorn.
So would you describe for us, principal, what happened in Princeton once the grant was awarded and how long you can have that?
Ms. Muckenhorn.
Sure. We were contacted and we determined a date that it would be open for us. And we had several months, and I'm going to say it was like 4 months. I took the liberty, as is per my position, and put a deadline for our staff because we wanted to see that it would work. And I also required it for everyone, as I also can do, so that we had a starting point for our entire staff. So that year, everyone met this licensure requirement, but we could have had it open the entire first two trimesters, I believe. NAMI was very generous with the time, so I probably used less time than I had available.
Representative Erickson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what will you do in the future then as new staff come on board?
Ms. Muckenhorn.
As new staff would come on board, I'd work with the district. There would be a time period, and we would really try to put that in place in that back to school. We have a 3-day training time for new teachers. That's where we'd put it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Mrs. McNahern, question for you. They referred to the 2% a little while ago that you used for development.
Right.
What that consists of? Do you use that whole account up pretty much every year with teacher request already?
Ms. McNahern?
The 2% of basic revenue set aside is determined at the district, so an allocation is given to each school. This year, the allocation to the high school was about, I'm going to say, $8,000, which is significantly less than 12 years ago, perhaps even more than half, and yet a couple or $3,000 more than a couple of years ago. In our building, not every single decision around that funding is made by, for example, a teacher committee with myself. I have some discretion over that. I create the original budget. And we do have teachers that apply for things. So if I had to, if there was sufficient funds, I can pay for certain staff development days, opportunities. It is a challenge. $8,000 for a staff of 100 and about 52 teachers, that doesn't go a long way. And, oh, I'm sorry.
No.
It's not my. A clarification of the licensure requirement. I hope I'm not misspeaking. It isn't the responsibility of the school district to provide that. It is the responsibility of a teacher to have that requirement to renew their license. So not all school districts are going to provide this opportunity, which is why I think this is very important for all of Minnesota.
Representative Hewitt?
One follow-up with actually Representative Richardson. Are we looking also at the new teachers coming in getting the same training?
Representative Richardson?
Yes, I think that the goal would be also some consistency in terms of having teachers to be able that are coming in new to be able to have access to training as well. And as Ms. McHaren was just saying, there's a responsibility for teachers to be able to get the training, and this is going to be a way for schools to be able to help, I think, erase some of the barriers to access.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either before or against House File 813? Seeing none. Representative Richardson, any closing comments?
I would just like to thank all of the testifiers for coming in today and coming as far away from Princeton to share their experience.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative Richardson renews her motion that House File 813, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a future Education Finance Division report. With that, thank you all very much. We stand adjourned.